Hello there, and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast. My name is David Brook, and we're here to talk about comics. I say we because there's someone else here in the booth.
Hello, I am Forrest with two R's, and I am also excited to talk about comics.
We are literally standing inside a booth. He's right behind me, so sometimes I talk first because I'm closer to the mic. It's not his fault.
But sometimes I get to astral project right in front of you, or like right on top of you.
Are you still working on that ventriloquism?
I'm still working on it.
Yeah, once you get that down, I mean, no one will know who's talking, me or you.
Right. And there will just be bits in the show where I sound very far away or like I'm in a pot or pan.
Yeah, I suppose ventriloquism doesn't work quite as well if you can't see the two people talking.
Wait, hold on a second. Is ventriloquism throwing your voice?
It is.
Okay. That's ventriloquism when you can make your voice sound like it's coming out of like a garbage can, right?
That's correct.
But then also the dolls.
Yes, dolls. Okay, yes, puppets.
It's all the same thing. Okay. Got it.
Are you saying Oscar the Grouch?
I think he was ventriloquism squared.
Oh, man. That's some math I can't do.
Because he's a garbage can, which apparently I think is the only thing you could throw your voice into aside from a puppet.
Definitely not a giraffe at the zoo. Definitely not an elephant at the zoo. Definitely nothing at a zoo.
If you ventriloquize something else, it's called something else. I don't have a word for it yet. Lying.
If you're into comic book zoology, you've come to the right place. Because this is where we break down the animal, the beasts of the Southern Wild. Also a good movie.
That is a good movie.
Of comic book dumb. We talk news. We do interviews. And we review the best books of last week. And we look ahead to the week ahead.
And by the end of the year, we're going to be an Animal Man fan cast.
We are, yes. I'll be Swamp Thing. You could be Animal Man. We have a whole lot of news to get through. But before we do, later in the show, Johnny Christmas and Jack T. Cole will be on to talk about their new series, Tartarus, from Image Comics. So to get into the news, if you've been at all on the internets, Twitters, the Facebooks, probably not that, Instagram maybe.
I bet they're advertising on Facebook. You don't think they advertise on Facebook? They probably
do. I don't know. I don't try to go on there very much.
I deleted it.
There's a lot of wild beasts on there, which is a good theme of the show. Anyway, Empire is their next big event, which is crossing over the
Marvel,
Avengers and Fantastic Four. Yeah, Marvel. And they released all these one-page, sort of almost like covers, teasers.
A lot of the advertising that they did for Hawks and Pox, which this kind of reminds me of, you know, they did the most important moment in X-Men history and stuff. Those moments were in the books.
Yeah.
So that would make sense.
And it's also very it's like a collaged sort of poster style. I mean, Mike Del Mondo's cake with the Dormammu and Thor fighting. I mean, it's wonderfully composed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It'd be a great cover if Marvel ever thought to use it. But unfortunately, they're only using it for teasers. So we think. Wait a minute. We think the other way. But anyway, what do you think about this? Are you excited for Empire?
I was telling you just before we recorded that it's because I didn't read Incoming, admittedly. I need to get caught up on the Marvel events calendar. But if I were to look at these advertisements without the knowledge of Incoming, which I have been, I have no idea what Empire is about, which is difficult. I think it's a difficult proposition for a lot of fans, more casual fans who might follow only one character through books and stuff. Like, they still have this problem, and they're leading 2020 with this problem of like line-wide crossovers, tie-in events, and stuff like that. And I as a comics reviewer and comics podcaster, don't really know what Empire is about.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to imagine that on the shelf in your local comic store is probably even more confusing. And that's not to say anything of the quality of the book or the writers or the artists that are attached to it. They have great creators attached to it. But from the outside looking in, I have no idea what it's about.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't even the symbol, the Avengers Fantastic Four symbol they've created. I mean, it suggests that it's some sort of combo between the two, but there are covers. Some of these teasers don't have any of the Fantastic Four in them, just Avengers. One reoccurring theme is that you see a lot of Skrulls and aliens in some of these.
And Kree.
Not all of them, though. So I guess you could surmise that it's some sort of space battle.
Some sort of cosmic event, which makes sense. I mean, they ended the year on Annihilation Scourge.
Yeah.
So it seems like everything is kind of pointing that way. A lot of the advertising has been like the secret war no one knew was coming. So it is entirely possible that the whole point is that you don't know what it's about until you are reading it. But that's a risky choice.
Since Hulkling is presumably the center of all this, and he's a Kree Skrull you know, Kree Skrull ancestry, one could surmise
23andMe.
The Kree Skrull folks are getting together, you know, even though they want to kill each other usually, to do something to Earth, because of course Earth is the center of the universe.
His familytree.com thing looked fucking nuts.
Oh yeah. Wow. Yeah. Ancestry.com? Yeah.
Yep.
we should send this to Ancestry.com and see if they'll give us money.
The other thing that you wanted to talk about was these crazy new costumes, right? Because it looks like Fantastic Four, written by Dan Slott, is tying straight into Empire. And it is, I don't know if it's actually called Avengers Fantastic Four Empire or whatever, but they have these crazy new blue costumes. It's got Spidey and Wolverine on the cover, and then also the Reed Richards' kids.
Yeah, CBR.com had a Fantastic Four number 21 exclusive cover reveal, and I can't wait for this Marvel Legends of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Yet another costume.
I mean, you know, you and I like to buy the Spider-Man action figures. It looks a little weird. I don't know.
Yeah, the art's by Nick Bradshaw. It's very muscly. It's coming right at you. There are purple webs or pink webs, depending on how you see the hue. Franklin and Valeria are on the cover too, and they don't have a four on their chest, a V and an F.
Yeah.
Which is sort of interesting. I don't know.
I think it stands for very fun.
Hey, wait a minute. You know how earlier I said that the Avengers and the Fantastic Four are clearly like doing like a crossover here? Maybe everybody's a Fantastic Four member, just like Wolverine and Spider-Man are in this, and that explains the entire event. We should just wildly come up with crazy ideas that will never happen.
And this is obviously tying into the Al Ewing and Dan Slott and Valero Shiti written and drawn Empire event.
Likely, yeah. Like you said, we don't know enough to really get that hype yet.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to harp on that over and over, but last year, I really knew what War of the Realms was born out of with Aaron's Thor run, and I knew what Absolute Carnage was born out of, and maybe even Annihilation Scourge a little bit to an extent, or the Alpha and Omega issues help.
Yeah.
But this is, it seems like it's a big deal.
But.
And I don't know.
It's coming in April, and their big, big events don't usually start till a little later in the year, so I'm wondering if there's another bigger event coming, and this is just one of those month-long
events.
We have
discussed on the show before that there is some sort of top-secret X-Men thing pegged for May's new comic book day issue.
Right.
Obviously, the Hawks and Pox, Dawn of X stuff is wildly successful and popular. It is like, every week those books come out, they are the top-selling books on Comixology. So if they were going to lean hard into any event or any direction, I'm pretty sure it would be Hickman spearheading an X-Men event.
Since the Marvel solicitations for April haven't come out yet, we don't actually know how long this event's going to be or anything. I have a feeling when the May solicitations come out next month, we'll probably know how long Empire is.
Yeah. Too long.
Whether it's a six-issue event or whatever.
Too long in one podcaster's estimate.
I wonder which one. In our next bit of news, Previews World has come out with the top 100 graphic novels of the decade. Everybody's getting in on it. We did a couple weeks ago, and now they are too. So they've released all 100 on this list. All the books sold between January 2010 and December 2019. Number one, Walking Dead, Volume 1.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all.
As we all know, the Walking Dead TV show came out in this decade, so everyone was clamoring for that.
Yep.
Saga was number two. Again, not a surprise. That's a really popular series.
The first volume of Saga. Yep.
Yep. And then Batman the Killing Joke, number three. That's an interesting one. Why do you think that is?
There was the animated movie that adapted it.
What about Heath Ledger?
Joker is always popular. Yeah.
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 Then Walking Dead, volume two, comes in at four. Saga, volume two, comes in at five. What's going on? They just own the top. And then Watchmen at number six.
Yeah,
that's likely sales just this year, right?
There's an obvious connection for that. Yeah, I mean, I think Watchmen is always popular, but there's no doubt that the HBO thing helped a lot.
Saga's all over this list. Batman Return, or Dark Knight Returns, I mean. Batman Hush, Batman's all over this list.
Infinity Gauntlet comes in at number 12.
Yes, yes. Any surprises? Anything that strikes you?
I mean,
as
I am
crazy?
Pretty surprised by how many of the top 10 are Image.
Yes,
there is only one Marvel trade in the top 10, and if I had chosen any, it would have been Infinity Gauntlet. But it's actually Civil War,
right?
Quite a few of these, the most, I believe, are Image. And only one of them is at their new trade price point of $9.99.
Mm-hmm.
That I think may have started with Saga. I may be mistaken about that. But the Walking Dead trade was $14.99, and quite a few of these are even more than that. So that's kind of surprising to me. I've always, if I were to give any benefit of the doubt to Image, it would be because they do that marketing, which is, I think, a really great idea, those lower entry cost first volumes. But I'm surprised to see that people are shelling out the cash.
Yeah, Monstrous Volume 1 came in at $10, and that was 25 on this list.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Paper Girls, I think they basically dominated the top 50. And if you're in the know, I think graphic novel sales are huge money for these companies. Huge money.
Yeah.
And again, but once again, though, sales are good. I mean, bad.
Everything is up right now or trending upward. Digital, graphic novels, and even the direct market for single issues is trending upward right now, which is great. I mean, that's kind of something we talked about all throughout 2019 on the show.
Right.
You know, I think that we're reaching a point where buyers' capacity is a problem. They don't have as much money to spend on all these comics.
Which we'll get into a little bit later in the show.
And that's why graphic novels are trending so well, too. So it's awesome to see Image in particular performing well, because I'm very adamant about supporting indie comics.
For sure. Not related to indie comics, Catwoman is getting her 80th anniversary this year.
Yeah.
Yay. So wait, hold on. Let's just back this up for a second. So they've done the Action Comics. They've done Detective Comics with big anniversary issues last year.
Wonder Woman 750 is coming up.
Are they going to do like every character? Like, are they just going to go through their line? Flash will get one, obviously.
Will get one. And there's obvious ones. Aquaman will get one. Catwoman seems pretty obvious to me. Green Lantern, yeah. Wonder Woman has issue 750 coming out, like I just said. All the Justice League. Well, no, not Martian Manhunter. That would be weird.
He was probably invented later too. Yeah. Anyway,
and also he's just kind of always there.
We're gonna be like 90 when like I'm trying to think of a new character.
Yeah. What characters do you think? Like 90 years of Miles?
Well, in 90 years, Batman will no longer be popular, and Spider-Man will be at DC Comics. I'm calling it right now. I'll be long dead.
Miles will be really popular still.
That's true.
Potentially Spider-Gwen too.
So this Catwoman anniversary issue is 100 pages. It's coming out April 15th, and it's gonna feature, much like their previous DC Comics' previous 100 page anniversary issues, a ton of creators doing short stories, one to three page stories. They've got a lot of great creators on this, including Ed Brubaker, who's kind of a surprise. He hasn't been doing superheroes
too much
lately.
Yeah, I mean, he just does like a one-volume crime comic every year.
Yeah,
so that's Criminal. Interesting. I like Criminal a lot, so that's neat.
It's not a surprise, but I have to say, when I saw this news, I was like fatigued by it. Like, we have more of these coming.
Yeah, I mean, there's such a high price point. Maybe that's going to be the talking point this year. Is like, I don't have all the money to spend on all this. As cool as it is, I also feel like, for whatever reason, and especially because this seems like the perfect place to do it, they don't really tell essential stories in these comics.
Not at all. Nope.
There's never been a time where it's a celebration of the character, where the character's been, and maybe where the character's going, but you never have a story in there that's like, this completely renegotiates what Catwoman is about.
The end of Detective had a story leading into Peter J. Tomasi's storyline with that knight from the video games.
Oh yeah, the Arkham Knight. Yeah, sure.
But
and
it was like this.
Neat, but it's not
it was like a little preview. Yeah.
You know, you would think people would go bat for the rafters.
They should do big things like kill Alfred or something in these.
I do think that this title page, "The Art of Picking a Lock," that we have over on AIPTComics.com. This is the story written by Ed Brubaker with art, color, and letters by Cameron Stewart. This cover page is slick. The art in here looks awesome.
Yeah, Stewart is usually doing colors, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Just colors. So it's pretty cool to see him drawing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a bunch of decades covers for this, just like there is for Wonder Woman number 750.
In our next bit of news, this is a pretty well-written story by Chris Aaron over at Newsarama. He interviewed Eric Stevenson, who is the Image Comics publisher right now, and they were talking about sales and price points and whatnot. I highly recommend you go check that article out. Anyway, there's some interesting information in here. First of all, according to this article, there are 5,395 comic books that came out in 2019. That's a lot of books when you times it by $4 to $10.
Yeah.
And Stevenson goes on to talk about how these comics, $4 or $5 an issue, not to mention Marvel and DC flooding the market with books, which I've mentioned on the show. Like, there are some weeks where Marvel has 28 books in 1 week.
Yeah.
It's killing the industry in a sense that if you love all these books, you can't possibly buy them all unless you're rich. And also, you need the time to read them, even if you were rich. And Stevenson goes on to say, like, what they're trying to do at Image to be better about this.
Yeah.
And one thing he points out is that he actually turned down a solid sci-fi pitch.
Yeah,
because he realized they have too many sci-fi books at the time, which I want to talk about that.
There's a thing here where the direct quote is, for instance, I was recently sent a pitch by a creator whose work I really like, and while I personally found the idea to be very interesting, we ultimately passed on it because it didn't seem like the sort of thing that would have a very wide audience.
Hmm.
And I have some immediate reactions to that, but I do want to know what you think.
Yeah, it's kind of sucks in a sense.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, okay, as a publisher and as, like, you know, one of the heads of a giant company like Image Comics, you do need most of your job is trying to figure out what the market wants and how much they need. So obviously that's part of it, but to just assume that it won't sell is a huge, possibly a huge mistake, because with the right marketing, with the right timing, any book could do well. And I'm sure we'll see this story eventually, because it sounds like this person who pitched it is probably a solid creator who will eventually get it to be printed at Dark Horse or whatever.
Or Vault, but or that being Aftershock said, or whoever is directly competing with Image.
It comes off a bit like he's silencing the potential.
And it's frustrating because the earlier statements are so precinct about things we've been talking about and things comics readers and fans have been noticing for the last decade.
Yeah.
He says earlier on that, you know, we release about a third less books than ever before in 2019, and we did so because we found that it was doing really well for us. Well, that's, they have the numbers, they've crunched them.
Yeah,
it's impossible to deny that. And also, yeah, I might be more inclined to buy all the Image comics if I only have to buy 4 a week rather than 15 from Marvel or whatever, right? Just to check it out, just because they have other books going on. But to assume that you know what your audience wants in that way, It's frustrating.
I mean, I guess he has to make hard decisions.
Sure.
When you only have a certain amount of bandwidth, you can't do it all, I suppose.
No, that's true.
I do think it's just odd to be like, okay, what are we putting out? Okay, we can't. I think it says in here something about, you know, there's too many sci-fi books or whatever. Let's do less sci-fi for this month or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that's an interesting way of thinking about the market.
Well, because it's such a weird genre-based thing rather than the viability of the story itself, right?
But you can't tell me Scott Snyder would, if he comes to him with this crazy sci-fi idea,
they would absolutely greenlight it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, as a creator-owned publishing house, they potentially could just publish anything. There's really any, they wouldn't say no to anything unless it was, you know, obviously offensive or something. But,
well, I wouldn't say that.
If Alan Moore came out of retirement, even though they had 400 anti-Trump comics coming out that month, they'd still let him publish it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a very, very difficult line to walk.
What's the over-under? Will there be more than 5,395 comics next year or less? Or this year, I should say.
I think that there will be... that is tough. Less.
That's a lot of...
Because, I mean, you have generally the third or fourth biggest publishers saying that they're publishing less.
Well, Marvel isn't, because they're coming out with X-Men God Loves, Man Kills Director's Cut from Chris Claremont and Brent Anderson, which I guess is going to be a reprinting of their comic, but with new material. They didn't get into too much detail on this. The news came out on Thursday. I'm sure there's a lot of X-Men fans out there that are excited for this. Salvador LaRocca did the new cover. I don't know. It's probably going to have, like, what, an extra backup in it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... I would be surprised if it was any more than, like, 6 pages.
Right.
But they do say that it's entirely new. So they're not going out and finishing pages that were supposed to originally be in God Loves, Man Kills or anything like that. Sometimes, you know, they do a director's cut version of a comic that has those things, sometimes even inserted directly into the story. The idea of Chris Claremont revisiting one of the most seminal X-Men stories in the current era makes me nervous.
That's true. That's like George Lucas going back and adding CGI animals in the background.
Right.
Could you imagine if they did that? If they like added like panels into the panels? That'd be wild.
Yeah. I just like like commentary.
Well,
commentary actually would be fine. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Talking about revisionist comic book storytelling, Dark Horse Comics is publishing a comic adaptation of the original Alien script after their hit Alien 3 adaptation from William Gibson's script.
William Gibson's, yeah, that was. Yeah. I liked that comic a lot. I thought that was neat.
Clearly, they're trying to keep the ball rolling with these adaptations of Aliens. We're probably going to get some wild new looks at the creatures, probably early, I would assume, early designs.
The cover for this looks awesome. This might be the original Space Jockey design.
I would assume so,
it's like some gothic horror Dark Souls shit.
He's like on a throne and he's got a weird head.
There's an absolutely crazy thing in here, and maybe Alien fans know this. I am a pretty devoted Alien fan and I hadn't heard any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But Cristiano Sexias, Guillerme Balbi, they're adapting O'Bannon's screenplay for 5 issues. It was heavily rewritten prior to filming by Walter Hill and David Giler, who, among other changes, renamed the film spaceship Nostromo from its original name, The Snark.
I'm sorry, if you put the in front of something and that's the ship name, I don't think that works.
It's really something. It's really a product of its time to name a ship something like that.
What if in The Matrix they were in a ship called the Nebuchadnezzar? The Nebuchadnezzar.
Mm, yeah.
I don't know. I think it's a bit much.
I mean, the Snark. It's more like if the Nebuchadnezzar was named the Glib.
Ooh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Right? That's weird. I don't know. But I love that that's what they're leading with in this press release, because that means there's some bonkers stuff in here.
That's true.
Which is awesome. I mean, William Gibson's Alien 3 script was like very much like a rebuke of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And that hasn't aged very well, or has it? But it was pretty interesting. I liked it a lot. It was very much a product of its time. The script, and mm-hmm. I think that the dialogue in the comic and stuff was more or less directly from the script, and it was pretty obvious, but it was very, very interesting.
I don't know if the title of this 5-issue series is that great. Alien: The Original Screenplay #1 is the first issue. I don't know. I feel like that's a bit much. Do we need to put that in the title, I guess?
I mean, I think it worked for Alien 3.
You can't just call it Alien.
Yeah, and you... unfortunately, the original writer's name does not carry as much weight as William Gibson's.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's out April 22nd. In our next bit of news, Jeff Lemire and Mike Del Mundo are releasing their own take on Immortal Hulk in The Threshing Place. Jeff Lemire, Mike Del Mundo, did I just have, like, one of my dreams come true?
That's crazy. It's a one-shot, but it's
going to be... It is a one-shot.
I may already pencil it in as the one-shot of the year.
I am loving Jeff Lemire's decisions lately. This guy is just killing it.
Yeah, it's great. And I mean, you know him and Al Ewing have got some crazy texts going on.
Oh, for sure.
Like, I'm very excited about this. The cover is awesome. It's like this big, bulky Hulk. He looks all mad, Immortal Hulk style. And then he's got holding up a little, looks like a hair clip. Daffodil with a smiley face on it, and just that is pitch perfect.
Yeah, a little girl goes missing in America's heartland in Kansas, and Hulk gets the itch to go figure it out, apparently, and I'm sure there's some terrible, terrible things that are going on in Kansas.
Yep.
Do you think there's any Wizard of Oz references in this?
Oh, maybe.
We hope so.
That movie scared the shit out of me.
Really? Which part?
Yeah. I mean, going all the way back to when the house lands on her.
Okay. The beginning.
I was like, they kill the lady.
How old were you when you watched it?
Probably like 4 or 5.
How does that make you feel?
I don't care for the Wizard of Oz.
All right. We have to tell him, guys. Forrest, this was all just therapy. We're now 55
We finally got him.
We were waiting for you to admit that Wizard of Oz scared you.
Got him to talk about the Wizard of Oz.
In our last bit of news, exclusively at AIPTComics.com, we have the solicitation for The Punisher vs. Barracuda number 1, written by Ed Brisson, with art by Declan Shalvey. This is bringing back Barracuda, everyone's favorite Punisher villain.
It is one Wikipedia writer's favorite Punisher villain.
If yeah, we looked him up.
If you need to get caught up on who Barracuda is, there is a very extensive Wikipedia article. And I'm not talking Marvel Wiki, fandom Wiki, whatever. This motherfucker put that shit directly on Wikipedia.com, and it has stayed. But it did catch me up on who Barracuda is, and apparently he was in an Eminem music video, so that's kind of neat.
And he died, so we have to figure out how he's back.
He's back.
It's set in Miami, et cetera, et cetera. There are gangs. Punisher's going to kill. It's going to be great. I think I'm excited for Shalvey.
I think Brisson is a great writer for these kinds of characters as well.
Oh, for sure. Yep.
Yep.
Ryan Stegman does the cover art as well. This is out April 2020. Ooh, go check that out at aptcomics.com and see it for yourself.
Heard some people are fans of that Stegman guy.
Stegman?
Oh. Stegman.
I thought you said Stegman. In our next segment, top books of last week, we're going to talk about the two best books, in our opinion, from last week. Before we start with our picks, though, we're going to tell you the top critic and fan pick from comicbookroundup.com. For the top critic pick, we've got Valiant Entertainment's Ray number 3 with a 9.0. Mm-hmm. And the fan pick was Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen number 7 with a 9.5.
That is a fun comic.
I am happy that these two books aren't on the list all the time, and they're on the list now.
Yeah. I really like, and it should be made clear that we're recording this Thursday night. Although a lot of reviews tend to come in on Friday and Saturday, the end of the week. Mm-hmm. Especially from sites that Marvel and DC don't provide their books to, or Valiant doesn't provide their books to. So it may change. But as of the time of this recording, that's a neat two books to kind of lead the second full week of January, the second full week of the new decade.
Mm. I want to read more Valiant this year. I haven't been reading enough Valiant.
Yeah. I mean, I like a Vin Diesel.
not because of Vin Diesel, though. I'm not sure about
those
that
movie. Comics might get the Vin Diesel bump. Ugh. I wouldn't rule it out.
The Vin Diesel. Why aren't there Fast and the Furious comics? I want to know. Ooh. Marvel. Wait, who owns Fast and the Furious?
Marvel. Warner Brothers? I don't know.
Probably Warner Brothers.
That's a lot of information I don't need to have in my
head. I need Vin Diesel to walk up to Henry Cavill as Superman and go, "We family?" And then Henry Cavill's going to go, "I'm an alien." And he's going to go,
"Okay."
Fly. And then a tank's going to fly out of the wall and kill him.
The writing process that you just tapped into, the place that your brain went?
Uh-huh.
Is absolutely how they made Hancock.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
I'm into Valiant. That's neat. I really liked Matt Kent's Divinity, so I'm glad to see. And Exo Manowar. I'm glad to see that they're continuing a good trend of. I like their little pantheon that they have. It's interesting.
Like 4 years ago, I reviewed almost every one of their books for a year, but then I kind of fell off because I don't know. When they reboot stuff over and over, Bloodshot felt like it kept getting rebooted.
Yeah, that happens. Jimmy Olsen is a book that I really do wish we had talked about more last year. Yes. Because that's just a great kind of like a reporter in the trenches looking at the DC world type story.
Right. Adding a bit of reality to it.
Yeah. It's reality, but it's also very funny, heartfelt, earnest. I like a lot what they're doing there.
That's Matt Fraction, right?
Yes.
Yeah. He was a big dog at Marvel for a while there.
Mm-hmm.
So, Forrest, what's your big dog number 2?
My second pick for top books of last week is Skull Digger and Skeleton Boy from Jeff Lemire and Tanchi Zanyek. This is, on its surface, a comic book that could be called Punisher Jr. But...
like, judging by the cover, Jr., or...?
in the sense that it is about a very tough, no-nonsense vigilante who wears similar armor to Punisher or Crossbones, training a younger version of himself, or not a younger version of himself, but a kind of protege. The execution, though, and on its surface, that's a comic-ass story, right? He's probably going to go too far, the kid's going to save him, or he's going to die and the kid's going to become him by putting on the suit. I kind of already see where this is going, but the execution is just so excellent and very well paced. I like the storytelling that the art is doing in particular, especially the colors, where all of the world kind of fades away. The pages get black and white when the kid is training. They do a segment in the middle where they're down in this basement under a food shop or a laundromat or something, and just training day in and day out. And I mean, probably having very intense conversations about killing people and stuff. And as the kid is growing up under the support or under the parentage of Skull Digger, like all the lights are harsh and red down on him, kind of showing that he's stoking this hatred in this young boy. And then they get this very stark, minimalistic fighting scene where they're training. It's all black and white. And you can really, it really imparts how the characters are feeling. And I like that a lot. And it's not the kind of thing that you maybe see in a Punisher Jr.
Yeah, it's a solid book.
It's taking a very simple comic concept and making it much more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the larger context of the Black Hammer history.
Yeah, I've reviewed both issues for AFPTComics.com if you want to check those out. I gave them high scores. my second favorite.
What was your number two pick? Yeah, there we go.
My number twos, as they say, is Batman's Grave Number 4 by Warren Ellis and Brian Hitch. Those are two names you've heard countless times in the last 20 years. These guys are probably at the top of their game, one might
say. Yeah, Batman's Grave is one of the best Warren Ellis comics ever, I think. It's awesome.
It's not even over yet. Lot. This issue in particular is, I would say, leaning on Hitch, and that's no offense to Warren Ellis, because Brian Hitch draws some mean action scene in this. It is basically an opening with Batman and Alfred. He goes to a place, beats up these dudes in a pretty long fight sequence, and then they have Alfred and Batman have a moment at the end. But the fight choreography is insane. If you like Frank Miller's Batman, you're going to like this issue because Batman is brutal. He's like a hammer when he comes down on these guys. Like, he literally breaks legs and arms because he has to, and he doesn't care. it's just so well done, and the coloring is amazing too. It's all at night inside this blue room, but there's all these great blue hues. I would just highly recommend this just for fun fight comic action. Check that out. What is your?
That comic has been building to a scene like that, so that's awesome.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because it's been very like detective element, not a lot of action.
Kind of a little bit of a fever pitch or boiling point being reached at the end of every issue. So that's awesome. I'm glad they're executing on it so well. Speaking of executing on things well, my topic of last week is Venom: The End, written by Adam Warren with art by Chamba Cruz. This is an insane comic book ass comic book.
It sure is.
Every third word in this comic's narration is probably made up.
Yeah, I want to know. I sent this to Dog, our science editor, and I was like, "Can you explain the science in this? Because I think a lot of it's fake."
I think a lot of it is fake, but it totally works for the idea of what they're trying to do. This is another one of the End comics that has come out. There's also a Miles Morales one. There's a Doctor Strange one coming out. It's supposed to show, in kind of a what-if-esque scenario, as the End comics have before, what the end of these the titular characters' comics or lives would be like. This one is absolutely bonkers. Venom is like, he keeps Eddie Brock alive artificially for 500 years until Eddie turns into like dust. And that's in the first two pages of the comic. It goes crazier from there. Venom takes over the entire universe and bonds with, I think they mean literally every person ever.
Yeah, all organisms.
All organisms, living planets. They bond with over a billion people. And it walks this really, really interesting line between like sad, very dark, and exceptionally funny. So, you know, as I had mentioned, it opens with him wanting to cling on to Eddie, and they show a vignette of Eddie's childhood that Venom is kind of peeking in on. And then, like, slowly throughout Eddie's life, Venom is there kind of like as a girlfriend on the beach and, like, all these, like, idealized things about their relationship. And it's very dark and sad and moving in the way that, like, Donny Cates' take on Venom is. And then it just cuts to Venom remixing itself into a ton of different people, and showing their powers and their different forms as like Storm and other stuff by literally being a DJ.
Right.
And like,
yeah.
wiki.
It's got a sense
like
of humor.
Saying remix mm-hmm. and pointing up to it. And it's just like the tonal whiplash would, with maybe any other character or any other book, be like, this doesn't work. But it totally works. It's very funny. It's very dense. The art, I bet the scripts for this were insane.
I know, right?
And Chamba executes on them perfectly. There's so much going on in every page. The colors really pop. The art is ridiculous. There's a ton of art, dialogue, narration, jokes, graphic design jokes embedded into it. It's like the most bang for your buck you will get this week. And the fact that it happens to be revolving around my favorite comics character is, I mean, I was sold on it.
Almost every adjective you used, I used in my review at ampcomics.com.
That's funny.
Bang for your buck, you know, dense. I have to add one thing. It's like a really good way of showing how Venom is the ultimate hero, the greatest hero of all time. I think,
yeah,
because
yeah.
He's literally saving all organic, all biological life so that we're not forgotten and destroyed forever. And it's done in an incredible way. Yeah, that script must have been insane. Adam Warren, actually,
it had to be.
I think he retweeted my review with a quote tweet, and he said something like something about the script being insane. I forget now.
Mm.
But yeah, and it's nice to see Adam Warren doing some Marvel work. He's typically just done like Dark Horse and stuff.
Yeah,
or indie stuff. Yeah, that's a great pick. I'm liking the Venom. I'm liking the End books because I'm a huge What If fan, and if you like What If, you'll probably like these.
The Miles one was very stylized in a way that was kind of not matching what Saladin Ahmed is doing right now. Mm-hmm. But I mean, like the Doctor Strange one looks awesome.
Yeah, I got to interview Leah Williams early this week about the Doctor Strange The End. I asked her what her pitch would be for Gwenpool, The End. And it's a funny answer. You should read it. I think she speaks as if she is Gwenpool, I think, in my opinion. You know, what's interesting is, okay, so I like this The End concept because it's basically giving What If a theme. If What If were to have a theme.
Yeah, yeah. The storytelling works better in boundaries.
Now, what if there was another What If theme that they did this with? What would be the theme? What if, so it would be like Venom, the marriage. Spider-Man, the marriage.
I would love to see, like, the doubt.
The doubt.
Like, a moment where every hero was like, I'm going to, the fucking, or like the.
I'm going to rob a bank.
I'm going to throw this comic in the trash.
That's good. I like that.
Costume in the trash, you know, the classic cover of Spider-Man walking away.
It'd be really good with villains who were like, maybe I should do good.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a Venom issue of that would be awesome.
Yeah, it would. My favorite book.
Get at me, Bob Iger.
Of last week is your second favorite book of last week, Skulldigger and Skeleton Boy number 2 by Lemire and
Yeah, boy.
I mean, you pretty much said everything I need to say except for the fact that the art the art by Zanich is, I think he's a visual story. His visual storytelling is bar none some of the best going on right now. Not only
the Lobster Johnson issues that he did.
Yeah. Oof. Like it's the layout design, it's the decision, because he's coloring the book too, it's the decision to not use color. There's a scene in this second issue where it's all white except for the black lines of the characters, and then we see color. I think it's draped in red. It's a really striking way to like draw this like emotion out of you, and the way he's laying out the panels, it's telling a story on top of the story. And I would love to see the scripts for this because I'm curious how much Lemire. I'm just going to say, I bet you Lemire is giving him a lot of leeway because this guy is clearly a phenomenal storyteller.
Yeah. You know what it reminds me of is there's a scene in Spider-Man Homecoming where they're stopped at a red light. And it's coming to the Vulture's mind that Peter is Spider-Man, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're sitting there at the light and the lighting on Vulture's face is all red. It's the stoplight. And then he realizes that Peter is Spider-Man, and he cracks this wry smile before he turns around to Peter, and the light turns green on his face.
Genius.
And that kind of, like, place-bound character storytelling is exactly what Skulldigger and Skeleton Boy is executing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It shows you that there's a whole other layer of storytelling that can be done that you don't normally see for whatever reason. Like Lonnie Nadler told us last week in the interview, Marvel is a sprint. And I'm sure a lot of these artists wish they had more time to tell a visual story, but they got to get that action book out now.
Yeah.
So that's a wrap on the top books of last week. In our next segment, Top Books for Next Week, we're going to talk about the number one book we're looking forward to out next week. Can I go first?
Go for it.
I am looking forward to...
I want you to go first. I want you to go right now. Go.
My most anticipated book out next week is... Where's my drum roll, Forrest? It's The Runaway Princess by Johan Tarnowski. It's a book from Random House. Wait, what? It's a graphic novel for middle-aged readers, middle-age grade readers, and it's...
Those are very different groups.
It's a 230-page graphic novel.
Oh, cool.
It's told in three chapters. Basically, this main character, Robin, is a princess, and she runs away in the first chapter. Second chapter, this isn't a spoiler, it's not a big deal. She runs away again, and then in the third chapter, she gets lost with her friends. This book is just stunning visually. Every two or three pages, there's a new creature or a new setting to look at. There's a new like monster that jumps in. It's tame at the same time. It's not scary, but there's also interactive elements where Robin will turn or other characters will turn to you and say, "Can you help us get through this maze?" And then you'll turn the page and it's a full page of a maze, and you have to literally use your finger to get through the maze. And
that's cool.
Once you get through, then you turn the page and they've gotten through. There's another one where inventor guy tells Robin, or he looks at us and goes, "Turn the page very quietly so that the bad guys don't know we're here." And it's just wonderful. And it gives you this sense of wonderment and imaginative storytelling that's inspiring. And the very last page, Robin's father's like, "Here's a map. We're gonna draw a map of this new area we've never been to." And you turn the page and there's a blank map and it says, "Here you go, reader, fill it in."
That's cool. That's really cool.
Also, for fantasy fans, there are full double page splashes of maps, like fantasy lands, and they all have fun names like the Silent Woods or the Ink Mountains, I think was one of them. Highly recommended. It's obviously a graphic novel, so it's not just a It's not a quick single issue read, but it's fantastic. I'm going to review it for AIPTComics.com next week, so check that out.
I think I will check it out. I loved, there was a time where things like Wreck This Journal were really popular. Do you remember
those?
No,
I don't.
It would say something like, "Smush a leaf in this page."
Oh, cool.
"Write your name backwards 100 times on this page. Draw whatever you want on this page," that kind of stuff. But there was no storytelling tied to that stuff. So it was interesting. You would do it every day and whatever. One of them was literally like, cut this page out, rub it in dirt, and tape it back in and stuff.
Nice.
And that was fun because you have a story in your mind every time you see something like that. Mm-hmm. But there was no direct narrative tied to it. But seeing that same kind of idea applied to a graphic novel is really, really exciting. Mm. And I bet... Johan had a really great time conceptualizing all of that.
Yeah.
Which is the kind of fun I want to know a creator was having when I read a book.
Oh, for sure. And this is good for adults, too. Like, I was just like, I can't stop reading this. It's so fun.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. I definitely will check it out.
Word?
My top book for next week is also one I'm going to check out. I don't know why I said that. Guardians of the Galaxy number 1, written by Al Ewing with art by Juan Cabal. I am a little bit concerned that Al Ewing is spreading himself thin.
Oh, don't worry. Marvel. This week is his last issue for Valkyrie.
Okay, but also Empire is happening.
That's true.
And there's a lot. Al has a lot going on. Yeah. But everything that he touches turns out fantastic. Mm-hmm. And if he can bring the same kind of energy, even if it's a different genre, different characters, whatever, to Guardians of the Galaxy that he was bringing to Immortal Hulk... Mm. I'm going to flip my nut.
Do you think he'll have a long run planned? He must, right?
I think that they probably do. I think that Donny Cates' take on Guardians of the Galaxy was intended to be a shorter form thing.
Right.
Just kind of playing around with characters and space and whatever. But I would imagine that if Al is on board, that this is much more involved and much more intentional. Juan Cabal's art was starting to become less consistent on Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man. They had a lot of fill-in artists, and I'm hoping that that's because he started working on this comic. Juan's work on All New Wolverine and also Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man, it's just so fun, so interesting. He imparts a lot of great, like, motion and fluidity and stuff into it. Like, very often you don't see how a character gets from the first panel to the last panel on a page, but Juan executes that so well. So I'm really excited for this. I think it's going to be very good.
And
I haven't been super excited about a Guardians book in a while.
It's been, well, yeah. I mean, yeah. I was excited when Kate's took over, and I kind of got burned out rather quickly on it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get into that right now, but that is a perfect example of how not to write a team book, I think. Because I was very excited by the stuff happening in the first two issues, and then it kind of completely fell apart for me.
It looks like Nova's going to be in this Guardians book. That's pretty cool.
Hell yeah.
And I love that Rocket Raccoon, at least in one of the covers, has the white suit on, which is a callback, I think, to Matthew Rosenberg's miniseries. Mm. Or maybe it's a callback to something traditional, yeah. But that was the last thing
I mean, you know, Al is all the way back to, like, the first issues of Hulk and Immortal Hulk right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pulling references and characters and missed story beats and stuff like that. So if you can do the same thing for as big and as expansive and as, like, weird and serious and scary and funny, all the cosmic stuff is, we're going to...
Oh, shoot. I thought you were describing me. Sorry. Weird, funny, cosmic.
I'm very excited for it.
In our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, we're going to talk about our favorite cover art.
Junior.
Boop, boop. And this is our chance to give the cover artists some credit where credit is due, because they sell these books, folks, most of them, unless it has certain writers' names on it or artists' names on it that you love. Anyway, sorry, I'm getting off topic. Forrest, what is your number one cover art of the week?
My number one cover art of the week is the variant cover, Francis Manapal's Batman Beyond number 40. This has Batwoman and the Batman Beyond on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all red and gray and black and white. And it looks exactly how you would expect a good Batman Beyond cover to look.
Nice. I feel like you should have just stopped at red. That would have been hilarious. It's red.
It just has that perfect it has found that perfect middle ground between, like, minimalistic and striking, with a really good depth, like Batman kind of wrapping his arms around Batwoman in the back, the shadows being cast on her cloak as they kind of descend the page.
Mm.
There's also some purple here, I suppose, but it's a really great study of figure as well as shading and tone.
Nice, yeah.
It looks how you want Batman Beyond to look. Batman Beyond has a look, and this cover has that look.
If you go to aiptcomics.com, you can actually see the covers on this podcast post. My favorite cover art was from Once in Future number 6, out next week, by Dan Mora. There's a color story going on here, which intrigued me. It's the skull creature holding a sword, and in the sword is a reflection of our hero. But we've got this bright sword. It's almost like a mirror. It's reflecting this character because he's looking right at us, about to strike him. And then your eyes move to the hilt of the sword, which is this yellow cross. And then you look to the right, and there's, like, the yellow eyes of this skeleton man. And then you look down and you see, like, intestines and yellow bones of his rib cage. And it's just a perfect line through the book from left to right. It draws your eyes so well. And then you start to take in all the details of the skeleton dude, his armor, the, like, bone crown coming out of his hood. It's so cool. And then he's got this red thumb fingernail. I guess he got into the nail polish or something.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Maybe he stubbed it.
Maybe. This is a series I've been trade waiting, to be honest. I haven't been reading the single issues.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's fantastic. It sells well.
Kieran makes good books.
So that's it for that portion. Next up, interview. Johnny Christmas and Jack T. Cole, they're on to talk about their new series, Tartarus, coming from Image Comics. Tartarus is out February 12th. On January 20th, this Monday, is the final order cutoff for Tartarus number one. So if you're a comic shop, this is the time to pick this book up for your ordering. So Johnny Christmas, you might know him from Sheltered or Firebug. Jack T. Cole, you might know him from The Unsound. Hang in. We're going to ask some questions and figure out what they're off-topic top shelf is, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to get to know him. We're going to have a little fun. It's going to be great. All right, and with us is Johnny Christmas and Jack T. Cole. They are coming out with Tartarus number 1 on February 12th, 2020 from Image Comics. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us, David.
Yeah, thanks.
I have to ask you, you've both been making comics for a while, Sheltered, Firebug, The Unsound, all fantastic books. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, and have you always wanted to make comics?
You go first, Jack.
Originally, I kind of started out with a bunch of ideas of things that I wanted to draw and was looking around at maybe I wanted to take them into writing novels or doing illustration or animation. But then comics just kept presenting itself as the perfect option for the amount of vision I could put in and story I could tell with them.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always, I think around high school was kind of when it, I always loved comics, but right around when I started seeing like a lot of the work of like, you know, Jim Lee, Todd McFarlane, especially, and then like, you know, the Image guys, like that kind of, that personal stamp that they had on their work was very telling to me. So that, and, cause yeah, at first I was thinking about filmmaking as well, but I don't have a rich uncle, and I know that's not, I know that's not the end all be all, but with comics, you could kind of do it yourself. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of like the freedom of being able to just like make any story you want. All you need is a pen, a paper, and a empty room, and you're good.
It's so quick too. Like when you put out an issue, you can kind of get a reaction from the audience rather quickly. Whereas if you make a movie, it's like a year or two of production, and then you get the reviews and you realize how people are taking it. Is that a factor at all? Do you guys look at reviews or fan reactions at all?
Sometimes they cross my path, yeah. And so I'll look at them, but I haven't gone particularly out of my way to find them.
Yeah,
I'd say about the same. Like I, at the beginning of a series, I do just to kind of like a little bit, just to, you know, check the temperature. Mm-hmm. But then after a while, then you have to kind of like burrow in and do your thing. You know, everyone's opinions are, you know, it's wonderful that people are sharing them and kind of having a dialogue about the work. But a lot of times it may not be helpful. The source may not be an informed opinion. Mm-hmm. Like it might just be an opinion.
I have come across, if it's like a professional review, sometimes they'll have critiques that are actually really a valid point. Like with The Unsound, I remember reading a review where somebody was talking about how strange some of the anatomy of my characters was, which was something I'd already been aware of. But when they pointed out, I was like, yeah, that's true. Hmm. As opposed to I came across a Goodreads review, and which I shouldn't have, you know, flipped through it, but like everything was like really positive except for one person who said that my art made them like physically sick and want to throw up.
Whoa.
And so that was like the one that stood out, and ended up remembering that one.
Some might say that's a compliment though.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the things where like at first I was like a little bit upset, and then I thought about it for a moment. I was like, good, you deserve it. To throw up if you don't like my art.
That's hilarious.
And I think another thing to keep in mind with a lot of reviews is that whether someone likes the work or not, like their job, one, is to write an entertaining piece.
Mm-hmm.
And entertainment requires drama and conflict and blah, 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 all the, you know, great storytelling things. So that's something I keep in mind when reading it. Like, right. Even if they love it,
yeah.
Most of the time, like sometimes people just go flat out and go, look, I love this. I got nothing bad to say. Mm-hmm. And here's why.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times people will say like a bunch of good stuff because they love it. And then they're like, okay, let me put a little bit of salt in here to spice some things up. And so it's good to keep that in mind that they're doing their job.
Yeah.
And it's not personal. They're just trying to make an entertaining piece.
Yeah, you see that with those snarky reviews where people are like just jerks. After a certain point, you're like, okay, now they're just like they've got a brick wall behind them and a microphone in front of their face. they don't care who they're hurting.
Yeah, I can see where a reviewer would not want to feel like they're necessarily writing a puff piece, so they come up with something to try and balance out to make sure they look like a impartial reviewer.
Mm-hmm. Back to Tartarus, the solicit for the title dubs it a new adventure series with all the sci-fi drama of Breaking Bad set in Mos Eisley. Can you expand on that a little bit in any way?
Jackie or Rian?
I haven't actually watched Breaking Bad, so I'm not certain where.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Title comes from. If I were to describe it, I'd say it's like a combination between Dune and Akira, because it has sort of the elements of the liquid having a sort of central element to the story in a similar way to the spice does, but then also involving these different competing government structures in the way that Akira does in the mega cities. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as far as the main title piece to describe it goes, I'm not sure how to extrapolate on it personally.
Well, my thoughts on it were, Jack and I had lots of conversations on where we're going with these characters in terms of development and, like, all the very kind of dark and interesting places and nooks and crannies. And the best way I could find to describe that was sort of the journey that the characters go on in Breaking Bad. It's like, they go on everyone goes on a journey in Breaking Bad, which is very fascinating. There's a lot of people who just seem like supporting characters at the start. Mm-hmm. Are very, like, they have, like, you can do a whole series on Schrader, you know, you can do a whole one on, you know, Skyler, you know, you could do, everyone is super fascinating. And I think what's wonderful with having an ongoing series is it lends itself to being able to really dig and really explore and unearth all these, like, cool things about our characters. We packed a lot of really cool stuff in there, a lot of, like, rich seeds that we can grow out into this, like, wonderfully robust world. So I think the Star Wars part is pretty obvious, but that's where the Breaking Bad part kind of comes in.
Oh my God, are we gonna get a Better Call Saul for Tartarus?
You never know. People are already starting to pick standouts, which is really interesting because the book's not even out yet, but like, people are, like, sending me messages going, like, hey, I really like this person or that person, or like, it's really interesting.
This world in Tartarus is so rich. I read a lot of comic books, and I was just astounded by how real it felt. There's all these different locations. There are so many vividly real characters. The costuming is amazing. It just all feels alien, but right, like, in that world. I've always been astounded by world building too. So it's always on my mind when I see something like this. What is the approach you take to flesh out so much variety and culture and depth in these characters? Are you the creators who, like, do biographies of characters and all that, or yeah?
Yeah, we definitely do. Like, we have, like, a backstory for pretty much everyone.
Yeah.
And even some of them are, if not a backstory, just like a really interesting character trait. Like, we have this one guy who's obsessed with the culture on Tartarus. And I remember kind of describing him to Jack, or my thoughts on what I think he should be before he started working on, was that it's like that person, you know, who goes to Jamaica for a weekend and then comes back with, like, braids and, like, Jamaican Me Crazy t-shirt, and they're, like, all about it, and they're, like, all of a sudden, like, a Rastafarian or something.
That's funny.
Like, that person, you know? When we all know that person, right? Like, so it's kind of like a cool little thing to know about a person when they start going forth, that that's where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. So we have lots of that for just about everyone. We kind of know kind of where they're from, what they're about, and where their place is in this, like, the geopolitical structure of the world, mm-hmm. and the crime structure of the world, and, you know, where they are emotionally in that place in their life.
When you have all that planned out and built out, is there a desire to sort of get it all on the page, or do you try to hold some of it back to keep that, like, imagination going, or are you thinking about that at all?
For me, I like planting the seeds. Mm-hmm. So it's cool, like, knowing all this stuff and then knowing which bits of it are the most relevant to the moment and the scene, instead of just, like, flooding, you know, everyone with exposition. I think, like, if you know who a person is, they can say the most interesting thing that's on their mind based on where they're from in that scenario, instead of just, like, giving you a whole whack of backstory. I think if they're interesting in the moment, you'll want to kind of hang around long enough to learn more. Just like if you go to a bar and someone tells you some crazy story of their weekend in Austin or something, you don't know where they're from or what they're about. But, like, that story in context of your conversation in that bar and that it went to Austin and what happened that weekend is going to make you want to, like, what is this? What's the deal with this person? Like, I need to know more. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I'm coming from in terms of story, and Jack puts a whole lot more in terms of the art into the background, into how our characters look, the way they move. So, and that just adds this whole other dimension where a lot of times I could pull out a lot of dialogue just on when I see what Jack does. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Like, it's obvious. Mm-hmm. So we could just cut back on words.
Yeah, I can imagine, Jack, you have, like, 14 spaceships designed, and only you only get to use two, and you're like, how do I get these other 12 into the book?
Yeah, sometimes I found too, when I'm designing some of them, when I come up with those designs beforehand and I try to fit them into a story, they don't fit the what the composition needs or what the page needs. Mm-hmm. So usually they end up being kind of, they influence what things will look like in the future. So they're, even if they're not directly used, they still continue to inform the visual language of the story. But yeah, every time I approach a chapter or a particular page, the designs of the ships and all the stuff in it are designed for that page as opposed to something I had built up before.
Makes it more organic, I'm sure.
Yeah, and it just, make sure that like they fit the tone that the story needs to tell.
Mm-hmm. The first issue is, at my count, a 46-page long story. When you started on this project, did you plan to create something extra size to start, or how did that pan out?
Yeah, that was something that Johnny and I had discussed when we were talking about what we want to do for the project. And I had been thinking about doing a double issue in particular because my opinion is that they give you an extra amount of time to make a strong first impression on the reader. And that way, also, when the reader buys issue two, they are essentially in chapter three of the story and are more invested in what is going on and have a strong impression of what they can expect for the future. So we decided to do that double issue to make sure there was that strong kickoff.
Nice.
Yeah, which was really helpful for this one, especially because I remember when we were talking about it, and it was like right at the top that we wanted to do a double. The first part of it with the circa and the jailbreak and the like intense action of it,
yeah,
was gonna be like, you know, like maybe like, oh, let's do like 10 pages of that or something like that, or and then kind of go into a Tilda story. But once we like started realizing like how much room we had, we're like, oh, we could really make this visceral. Like we can, instead of, we don't want to tell people how bad and terrifying Circa is. We wanted to show them. Mm. So every time her name comes up, the reader knows it because they've been there. Mm. So it was really great having that double issue where we can really expand and show just how badass and terrifying and incredible, and like what kind of carnage is expected if this isn't kept under wraps. So when things happen later on in this very issue, you know, there's a little bit more of understanding as to why people make the choices that they make, mm-hmm. because this is what can happen.
I was like, I kept scrolling because I read it as a PDF, and I kept thinking like, is this a graphic novel and it's not a series? Because this is crazy. Like, then this happens, then this happens, then this happens. It blew me away. And it like the epicness of the storytelling, I think, matches the world building and what you're trying to tell, I think.
Thanks, David.
The world is so unique. I have to ask, is this in our reality or is this a whole other universe or is it in a galaxy far, far away?
What are your thoughts, Jack?
The galaxy far, far away and being in another universe kind of function essentially similar. One of the things we talked about before we got started on TARDIS was whether to do alien species or not, and we decided to have it be humans and robots and robotic affiliated machines, mm-hmm. instead, so that it kind of focuses more tightly on human expressions and doesn't expand out into too many directions, since it already has expanded in quite a few directions visually. So we did that not to quite overwhelm the reader, but it also kind of has the second effect of being more visually similar to our galaxy. But I suppose fundamentally, since we're going into we're doing a lot of occult, alchemical, astrological themes that end up in the background. So there's a lot of influence of Greek, Egypt, and other ancient societies. Mm-hmm. So in that way, they mirror our own universe enough that it is kind of like just generations and generations and infinite generations removed.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It was actually a very helpful thing. Because, yeah, like when we first started going, like I had this whole like when you start branching out and like sketching out like, OK, and we can go here and we can go here and we can go here. And I was like, at one point, I was like, OK, and then there's aliens. And Jack, like, yeah, I don't like aliens. I don't want to do aliens. And it was just like, and it was very helpful because. Yeah. Like you said, Jack, it like focused us into like, yeah, let's stay here. We have like enough really cool, rich stuff here. Mm-hmm. And if we like turn inward and really dig and go into this like awesome symbolism and like mythological themes that we have woven all throughout, it's just, it's made the whole thing so much richer because you, and it sort of really kind of blows back into the characters as well. Cause we're all like looking, it's like having a fireplace at home and you're like, you're there and you can stay there like for, you know, for days, you know, like hunker down and sort of I'm going into the intricacies of everything in the room because it's so inviting.
Oh, yeah, it sure is. I also love how diverse the characters are in this book. Was that something you were actively thinking about when you were like designing the characters and stuff?
Yeah, I was thinking of how different populations might make up how Tartarus looked.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I was thinking with how that would be that it would influence different cultural aspects and yeah, essentially that.
I mean, it's not like Star Wars where everyone's white and British. That's sort of a joke, but not really.
Yeah, that was mostly Jax taking the lead on that. Like I was going on like kind of the inside and he was just kind of like, oh, what if like populations from here, here and here were kind of the norm. And like, that was kind of where people were sort of folks who colonized in this like a planet of sticks that Tartarus is on. And, but so yeah, so it was like a really interesting sort of baseline. And then from from that to have like how cultures would evolve there removed, of course, generations and generations removed in this sort of place could be really interesting. So it has like this very unique flair and its culture of its own, which I really rather enjoy.
Yeah, it sets it apart again in a great way, I think. When you're coming up with names for things in a sci-fi world like this, do you ever run into trouble with things that might sound similar to our world? Like, for instance, in issue one, there's Tum Tum Barrels. And I don't know why, but my mind immediately went to Tums, the like medicine.
With Tum Tum, I just thought of like someone rubbing their belly.
Okay.
Oh yeah. And like, oh, it's so nice and tasty. I love my Tum Tum. but yeah, with names, I was trying to come up with there's a word for it, but there's a word for how you come up with words. Mm-hmm. But I have sort of a matrix as to how you come up with names and from where they're from, because of course we have two different empires. We have Baxen, we have Juria, we have the folks there on Styx, there in on Tartarus. And so the Baxons, they generally have lots of like hard consonant sounds.
Oh,
and,
interesting.
You know, so yeah, so there's lots of, and there's like, we'll probably never say it, but you'll see it in the background. Like Tilda's name is like, Hansa Tilda 348/348. So she's like the 348th Tilda from Hansa province in Baxen. You know, so there's all this stuff that like we know about this world that's just kind of like tucked in the background. So, So there's kind of sounds that we want things to sound alien, but easy enough to pronounce, you know? So Tilda looks like Tilda, like you could, you know, it's actually an English word, but you know, like circa, you know, you can kind of, folks can have it in conversation. What I'm interested in is hearing how people pronounce like Ilns or something like that. That might be kind of cool, but for the most part, kind of have a method to how the sounds and the evolution of how their language translated into English might sound.
That's awesome.
I've really loved the names Johnny has been coming up with too. And in particular, what Johnny's been doing with dialogue, like he has a really unique voice that he writes with and comes up with all these great different turns of phrase that feel very unique to the world that's being created there, but also to Johnny as a writer.
Yeah, thanks, Joe.
You just made me realize our naming structure in on Earth is not as good as what it is in Tartarus, because I want to know, like, how many Brooks are there? Am I, like, the 400th Brook or only the 5th? I don't know.
Exactly, right? It just clears up a bunch of confusion.
It does. Like, yeah. Ancestry.com should make that part of their thing, where, like, you do the ancestors, and then they go, okay, this is how many names back you go, so you're number 7.
Like you were just saying, when we got on the call, like, you were trying to find Lonnie on
stage. Yes.
And there was, like, 4 other Lonnie Nadlers, but if he was Lonnie Nadler 3... And you'd be like, oh, yeah, there he is.
And I was talking to the wrong Lonnie Adler. He never replied back, but I mean, I was chatting him up.
It would have been great if you had like a 2-hour conversation with him.
I know, right? And he's like, I don't read comics. Why am I on the show? So what sort of themes are you guys exploring in this series? Like, I understand, like, discovering where you come from is a big one. Are there any other themes, or is that a theme that you're working on in the series?
Yeah, that's definitely a part of it. And one of the ones we've been discussing is aspects of duality and opposite. There are twins that appear and also are big into the folklore of Tartarus itself.
Ooh.
And also having different things up against one another that seem opposite, but by bringing them together, there's a sort of aspect that appears. One of the ones I've been talking about in various places is I like to put a lot of images of garbage in places, but also pictures of shrines and other divine things. And I think the juxtaposition of the two often reveals different aspects about who the people are who live in a society and what they both exalt and what they use and get rid of, and those things that then essentially tell us about the people living there based off of those things is a theme I like to explore visually and is enhanced by the narrative themes that Johnny has been developing.
Yeah, duality is a big one, and sort of the completeness, life, death, and this sort of thing. Like, so for example, like in Tartarus, we have this thing where everyone's born, like children are born in pairs, basically there,
mm-hmm.
but generally one always dies at birth. And it's sort of symbolic of how Tartarus is this kind of this land of death. And it's sort of, and what does that do to a culture if there's like the mortality rate is that, the infant mortality rate is that high?
Mm-hmm.
And what else does that signify in terms of what's missing, right? So the land of death, you know, so life is missing. There's like, so there, it's this land of want, you know, and this land of war, and everyone's striving for peace and life. And like that creates a tension. So you have this empire that's kind of hovering above it. That is like the land of plenty that needs something from this land of want, you know? And so then you get smuggling, and then you get, you know, all this like crazy cultures that are coming up that are trying to reach for the sky, and the sky gods may not be looking down on them very, you know,
no.
generously, you know. Yeah. So not sky gods literally, but you know, yeah. so it's all this like really interesting stuff that we have layered in that we don't really have to hit very hard, because like Jack says, you've got temples and garbage. Like, he had this really great quote, Jack, about like glamour and garbage. I love, and it's, yeah, you've got all these juxtapositions running next to each other that aren't too far from the world we live in, right? So in many ways, so it's kind of cool. Like, if you go to a third world country or a developing country,
mm-hmm.
you'll see this, you know. Like I remember I was in Senegal like many years ago, and walking through like the streets that where the embassies were, it was like beautiful. It was like tree lined, and like you could have been in like any country, like any you know Western country in the world. And then like, you know, six blocks later, you're like in a place that like was really, you know, kind of poor. This was like in the city. Like most of where I've been in the country, that country was really beautiful and chill.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a very interesting little segment where you've got these like really lovely folks who are just like funny and charming and wonderful, but depending on which block you're in, like there could be a bunch of stuff around that, you know, it could be a lot of want, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then a lot of plenty. And it always kind of stuck with me. It's very interesting.
A world of want and a world of plenty. Interesting. I have to say, the color in this series is very distinct. Is there a story you're trying to tell via color?
Yeah, definitely. Part of the first bits of color you'll see is a result of me, coming off of working on The Unsound, where I was experimenting with color to try and create different moods and tones, and also a sort of abstract sense of fear, like when some very strange and bizarre things happen in that story, colors will sort of blanch out into this green and pink palette or go completely white. So when I was approaching the first chapters of Tartarus, I was having this new tool set that I developed with color, and was also very into comics from the 70s and 80s and their brighter toned color palettes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was incorporating these influences. And then also one of the things I had brought up with Johnny too, that I really like about Star Wars is the color palettes of those original trilogy movies are very distinctly memorable. Like when I think of each movie, I can think of A New Hope as tan, blue, black, and white, or green. And then The Empire Strikes Back has that white, blue, black, and orange. And then Return of the Jedi is tan, blue, black, and green. And each of those movies and the different locations have these color palettes that stand out in my mind and I think make the story of it more memorable because I can associate it with those colors. And I was trying to get some of that with Tartarus. I think in the case with Tartarus, a lot of the bright colors ended up being attached to specific pages. So maybe I got too atomized with trying to apply it. But part of creating a distinct place that when you look at it and you see those colors and then you put the book down and think about it later, you'll think of those colors and remember those places.
It's interesting. It hits a different part of your brain, doesn't it? The color palette of something. That's really cool. It kind of just makes it more distinct, even more so, on top of everything else we've talked about today.
Yeah.
I have to ask you, what are your top three sci-fi anything? Movies, comics, books, anything? This is me asking, what may have inspired Tartarus?
I'll go first. Just because I'm this
question
terrifies me. Yeah. I'll just rip the band-aid off. Akira, number one. Let's go Star Wars just because it got in there early and it's the, you know, it's probably the granddaddy of them all for me. And then, you know, I don't know if this is a true statement, but it's the one that's coming to top of mind. And maybe because it's more recent, but The Arrival.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm throwing that one on in there.
Nice. Good list.
Just for today. Tomorrow, it might be that the third one might chip, but I think that's where I'm going to. Akira's definitely any day, Akira's in there.
And is that the is that the manga or the anime or
manga.
Both?
Manga way. Nice. Manga all the way.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Jack, do you have a list?
Yeah, I'm still deciding what the third one is, but I think number one, I'd put The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin, since that was one that introduced a whole bunch of anarchist politics into science fiction in a really interesting way. My second favorite piece of science fiction is the Ghost in the Shell anime.
Oh, yeah.
That's one that I have watched several times over, and I can't parse out precisely what's going on from just one watch. So every time I rewatch it, I pick up new things about what's going on. And that's one that I think is like really powerful and inspiring for storytelling, because it does have this central, exciting plot that if you're just watching it cold like that, you can get a great amount of entertainment from it. But then it has all these extra layers that, as you keep rewatching it, pick up on different internal politics going on or the philosophical ideas over evolution and AI. And in addition to that, the scene in the middle of it where there's this vocal song playing and you're looking at all these different scenes of the city and it's raining.
Yes.
It's very like, it always just gives me chills. And all of these contemplative moments that Ghost in the Shell manages to put alongside very thrilling and well choreographed action is extraordinarily inspiring.
For sure. Yeah, that's a great choice. One of my first DVDs I ever owned, I think, Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah, it's like, I think that and Akira coming out were pretty big for a lot of people.
Yeah.
The third one, Roadside Picnic.
I haven't heard this one.
Fantastic book.
Yeah.
And also Stalker, that Andrei Tarkovsky based off of it,
oh,
is another
okay.
one that I absolutely love.
Nice. Okay, one last question before we get to our next segment. In the ideal scenario, how long is the Tartarus run?
I want readers to know that Tartarus is going to be ongoing. So that's how long we have in mind for it. We have an end in mind, but we're also, we want to see what the reader reaction is. We want to see where it's ongoing. So we're going to flesh this thing out, and we want to see, you know, what the response is and see if people are feeling what we're feeling and want to be immersed in this world as much as we enjoy creating it.
I saw Matthew Rosenberg talking about how, you know, people were like, how long is Hawkeye going to be? And he said, well, if you buy it, it'll be more than six issues. Yeah. But if you don't buy it, it's going to be six issues. And, you know, and then Donnie Cates was talking about piracy a couple weeks ago. And like people were like, well, Donnie, I can't afford it. And he's like, well, if you don't afford it, I'm not going to keep doing it. So buy the book, stop pirating. And we talk about this on the show all the time. Like, you need to vote with your wallets, especially with creator-owned books.
Big time. Like, it makes all the difference because it can be, they said it well. I can't say it better than that.
Okay, in our next segment, Super Fight, this is a segment where we pit two characters against each other via this Skybound card game called Super Fight. It's basically like a versus, but in a funny way. There's some ridiculous scenarios. A lot of our guests have laughed more than anything at this because it's kind of fun. So I picked two characters to pit against each other, and I picked Tetsuo from Akira, and I picked Zorg from The Fifth Element. That's one of my favorite sci-fis. And the Super Fight card, I'm going to just randomly select a card here. There's stuff like Best Lumberjack, stuff like that. It's ridiculous. Who would be the worst president? You're going to pit Tetsuo versus Zorg. Who would be the worst president?
Oh, geez. Refresh my memory on Zorg.
He was played by Gary Oldman.
Oh,
Gary Oldman. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Oldman. Yeah, yeah.
And he was working with this evil entity to get rich, but the entity wanted to destroy the universe.
Worse in what way? Like effectiveness?
I guess effectiveness would be a good trait of a president.
I would say Zorg would be worse.
Zorg would be worse.
I think Tetsuo would be better. I think he could be calm and he could do stuff so long as you aren't like getting to him on an emotional level for stuff he wants and stuff he likes. I think Zorg, from my recollection, was just kind of a madman.
A politician kind of working the system.
Yeah, a little bit meaner, felt meaner than Tetsuo. Like, Tetsuo was like mean, but for a reason. Like, he wouldn't just go and like mess you up for no reason. Maybe not a good reason, but he had his reasons. Zorg had reasons too. But.
What do you think, Jack?
To be honest, I haven't actually seen The Fifth Element.
Oh, okay.
So
I picked the wrong villain.
my problem is some of my pop culture and other movie references end up being much shallower compared to other people, so okay. I have a hard time with. But I can't imagine Tetsuo as president.
Because wouldn't he like get huge and blow up like a city or something?
Yeah. Well, basically, let's say he's in the White House. It would basically just be him with a throbbing head and all these people in suits bringing him piles of drugs into the Oval Office because he needs more. And basically, our entire system grinding to a halt because all of the to prevent the collapse of the government, everybody just needs to be bringing him drugs to prevent his headache from making him explode.
Right.
Well, at the risk of sounding disrespectful, and I don't mean this in a way disrespectful to this gentleman or his family, but isn't that the rumor with JFK?
Doing drugs?
Like, he had like intense back pain and all sorts of stuff going on.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Yeah,
they had to keep him they had to keep him at a certain altitude to keep the pain away from, being a distraction.
That's the rumor with Trump too, I think, right? He's like on Adderall or something. And that's why he always sniffs when he does his interviews or whatever. He's like, that.
Yeah, I think somebody asked Carrie Fisher a couple of years ago about whether or not it was the coke sniffle, and she was like, oh yeah.
So that's an interesting point. So Tetsuo is a drug addict. Zorg wants... he will do anything to get rich and wealthy. They have traits that are already in our presidents in the United States throughout the histories. So maybe they could both pull it off. Who knows?
Yeah, and Tetsuo wouldn't intentionally serve ultimate evil.
That's true. I think I'm going to side with you on that. I think Zorg doesn't care if an entire planet would die, whereas Tetsuo maybe is more apathetic and doesn't really think about that anyway. So even though Jack hasn't seen The Fifth Element, I think we're going to go with Tetsuo on this one. Even though you were against Tetsuo, but it's a two against one on this this vote. So, okay. In our last segment, Off Topic Top Shelf, this is where we just ask what you're into right now that's not comics related. It could be movies. It could be whiskey. It could be, I'm naming things that other guests have said, books. What are you into right now that's not comics related?
You go first this time, Jack.
Oh, okay. It's strange to say being into it, but well, I guess I can make it into a broader statement. Been getting back into just going into the library and then finding random books to pick up and read. I recently read a book called The Artificial Kingdom, A Treasury of the Kitsch Experience by Celeste Olal Quiaga. And I was expecting to pick it up and read this book that was about a whole bunch of different objects from the Victorian era, but it ended up being an entire treatise on how we perceive the value of objects because of its impact and the impact the Industrial Revolution had on it, and also how time and death factors into the idea of kitsch. And it completely changed the way I thought of objects and natural history and a whole variety of topics. So yeah, I'd say my big thing I'm into is just letting chance and mayhem take its course in directing me to different stuff at the library.
Nice.
I've been reading this book on Tashin put out a collection, and I think it's reprinted. I think what I got was a reprint on, I think it's called Alchemy and Symbolism. And it's just
I got that one.
Oh man, that thing's great. Like
Alchemy and Mysticism.
Mysticism, thank you.
The Hermetic Museum.
Yes. I've been like just like crawling notes down and reading this thing and looking at the beautiful imagery and then like that's spinning me off into other realms of research. And so I'm really enjoying that. And I'm also, I'm late to the party, but Fleabag, started watching Fleabag.
Oh, so good. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really,
it's addictive. Really
great. Oh man, it's so great. So like, yeah, me and the wife are like, we got started on it and we're diving in and we're digging it.
Well, that's it for this show. Thank you guys so much for being on. This was a lot of fun. Tartarus number one comes out February 12th. And thank you so much again.
Oh, thanks, you, David. David.